Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Brady McCartney, your host today. I'm joined by Evan Berry, editor of Climate Politics and the Power of Religion, published by Indiana University Press. He is an associate professor of environmental humanities at Arizona State University and president of the International Society for the Study of Religion, Nature, and Culture. Evan Berry, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So to start, could you tell us why you decided to edit this volume of essays on climate politics and the power of religion? And could you define those key terms, climate politics and religion?
Sure. So this edited volume is actually one of two books that was the end result of a multi-year research grant by the Henry Luce Foundation. The grant was called Religion and Climate Change in Cross-Regional Perspective, and it was administered by the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at American University. So we had been working on that project for several years and cultivated about 20 to 25 scholars and research projects, and we're looking for exactly how to gather them. So this volume focused on engagements of religious actors and ideas with the policy and political struggles around climate change. The other focused more directly on lived experiences of people in communities affected by climate change and the role of religion in shaping and it's an intersection with their experiences of climate impacts. So the key terms that I think are important, we use in the title climate politics, and authors in the volume speak variously about climate catastrophe, climate change, and climate crisis. Of course, those words all have different emphases, but broadly, we're thinking about the role of human economic activity in producing greenhouse gases and the changing geo-atmospheric systems and the ways that those changes are harmful and deleterious both to human life and to ecosystems and other than human life. Those impacts are, of course, predominantly caused by wealthy societies in the global north, and the impacts of those changes are felt predominantly by poor nations and more vulnerable people in the global south. And so there's all sorts of problematic and challenging questions for researchers in this field about how we think about responsibility, how we think about causality, how we think about human solidarity, how we think about cultural and social differences. And so the volume targets those questions in particular, as we think about climate change as, of course, a global problem, but as a problem that's understood and received and debated in very different terms in different parts of the world, and thinking specifically about how religion plays a role in shaping the distinct nature that those different sets of debates have.
Okay. So you write, quote, "The climate crisis is a spiritual crisis." So you're a religious studies scholar. I would also describe you as a scholar with many other backgrounds, but I know you as a religious studies scholar. So why do you believe this to be true, that the climate crisis is a spiritual crisis?
I think one of the things I like about that phrase, or about thinking about climate change as a religious or spiritual crisis, is that there are multiple layers of meaning to that. So on the one hand, I think the climate crisis poses challenges to the kinds of traditions that have traditionally been thought of as religions, that thinking about nature and the environment and as part of a system in which humans are participants but are not fully in control destabilizes many of the theologies that have been dominant over the last several millennia, right? There are sort of some assumptions about what human beings are and how they relate to their environments that are relatively typical across Holocene traditions. And the Anthropocene brings those traditions into crisis. There are other ways that climate change is a spiritual crisis, in that it asks us questions about where we are, where we're headed as a society, what our futures will look like. It has an eschatological quality to it that remains unanswered. And spirituality and religion are an important part of how people, both individuals and groups, navigate those unknown and indeterminate futures.
So the title of this volume is Climate Politics and the Power of Religion. I can imagine some listeners wondering, like, what do climate politics and religion have to do with each other? I would also imagine you've had to answer this question both for yourself and for others. So how do you answer that question? How do you explain the various connections?
Yeah. You know, I get this question a lot in my work in general. I've gotten it in many different ways and shapes over the years. I think climate politics is a discrete sub-area of environmental politics. An important part of it is about the way that multilateral institutions are grappling with the climate crisis and the role of national governments in contributing to those international streams. Religion plays really important roles, both in terms of shaping how individual nations participate in international negotiations around climate change. So, for instance, you can't really understand how the United States comes to the particular kinds of positions that it does in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change without understanding how our politics in the United States are fragmented in many different ways, but especially around religion, religious difference, religiously inflected ideologies. The same is true in other nations. I would name as a key example in India, where the BJP is a distinctly and specifically religious actor, and that shapes how that party responds to climate change on the international scale. There's also a really interesting set of debates around how climate change is understood and responded to inside of nations. So the politics at the national level are also sort of curiously and distinctly shaped by religion in lots of different parts of the world. We might look at a country like Trinidad, where fossil fuels are a really important part of the nation's economy, petroleum production, and national level politics are, like the United States, structured around a set of religious differences and that intersect with other kinds of difference, but you can't sort of take apart and fully separate how environmental politics works from the way that religion influences politics more broadly. So the book is a series of case studies that dive into the different ways those things cling together across different nations.
So to sort of drill down into, I guess, the religious and spiritual side of this book. So how have the impacts and sort of the ongoing threat of climate change already created or will create new material conditions, new political realities for religious communities, religious peoples, religious actors? And how is climate change already shaping the lived experience of religious peoples? You've obviously started to allude to it, but maybe we can flesh it out a little more.
Yeah. In order to answer that question, I'd like to back up just a bit to say something about how the research project generated this and a second edited volume called Understanding Climate Change Through Religious Life Worlds. That was edited by David Haberman and is also University of Indiana Press. The project envisioned that there are three distinct ways of articulating and researching the religion-climate interface, that one of them has to do with how religious actors, understood in a relatively conventional and traditional sense, act in relationship to climate issues and how they engage in climate discourses. The definitive example of that is, of course, the papal encyclical Laudato Si, which the Catholic Church deployed strategically as a way to, you know, engage international politics on climate change. A second way to think about the religion-climate change interface is to look at how religious discourses and ideas are embedded in the way different cultures think and talk about the environment. So how words like nature or creation or stewardship may or may not be salient in different kinds of contexts. Religion is sort of always in the background of how human communities think about nature and the environment, or at least the tools of scholars of religion are uniquely significant for uncovering and thinking about how those cultural articulations of nature work. The third way that we explored in the volume is more in line with what you're asking about, which is about how climate change is changing the conditions for religion. So I think there are a whole bunch of different ways to answer that question. And one of the things I enjoy about the volume is that our authors took that in really different directions. So I would give you one example from my own chapter, which is about the concept of political opportunity. You can see that climate change presents a set of questions for religious actors, both on the global stage and nationally in the United States, to get their message out there. It sort of it gives them a way to brand what they're doing and to have to respond. So it's not just that they have the option of responding, but that it's become such a major part of how any kind of institution or organization develops its public engagement that it conditions groups to go down different kinds of pathways. So organizations and communities are sort of forced to decide whether this is an important issue to them or an unimportant issue, whether they want to deny that climate change is scientifically verifiable, or to deny that science is an important part of getting information about how the world works and what we should do in response to what's happening around us. Or they have to embrace the science and they have to think about what the relationship in a very specific way is between their own teachings and scientific knowledge. So in the case of the Catholic Church, again, it's not irrelevant that in the decade or so leading up to Pope Francis's encyclical, the Catholic Church had been in perennial crisis about things like sexual abuse, corruption in the Vatican Bank, declining participation and affiliation with the church. And so something like climate change, which had not been absent from church teaching before that, was lifted to a higher level of emphasis as a way for the elite of the institution to speak out about connecting to youth, about reasserting the Vatican's powerful position in international politics. So there's all sorts of ways that it climate change sets conditions through which religious actors have to rethink where their place is in the modern world. There's also, I think, a more granular way to talk about how climate change changes or affects religion, and that's to look at the local places where religion is lived and practiced and experienced. A number of cases, both in this volume and its companion, point to pilgrimage sites or local places that are undergoing rapid ecological change or degradation. And local people have to respond to that when young people have to move away because the agricultural jobs that have been a community staple for generations are no longer sustainable, and they have to move to cities or to other countries to make their livelihoods. There aren't young people to learn traditions and rituals. When a glacier is the object of veneration or the site of pilgrimage, as it is in a number of places in both the Andes and Himalayas, when those glaciers retreat or melt or are unstable to the point that it's not safe for humans to walk on them, those traditions, those pilgrimage sites change. And so how communities adapt to that is important as an object of study and knowledge and of contemplation about what's being lost through the climate crisis. I think a lot of times the way we think about sea level rise and ocean acidification is very rational and utilitarian. You know, fishing stocks will be depleted. Cities will have to pay more money to have infrastructure that allows them to adapt to rising sea levels. And that those ways of thinking about and talking about climate change, especially in the media, fail to capture something about the lived experience and the cultural violence that's being done through atmospheric anthropogenic climate change.
Thank you for that. I would also recommend to our listeners that they listen to earlier interviews I've done with Todd Lavoisier on his book, Climate Change, Religion, and Our Bodily Future, and Robin Globus Feldman and her book, The Gospel of Climate Skepticism, because I think, Evan, you have helpfully pointed out that religions are not uniformly going, quote, green or the reverse. They are not, you know, skeptical of the science, again, uniformly, right? There's a lot of different responses from various traditions. And even within a tradition, you know, there isn't necessarily uniformity.
Absolutely. Those are both great books.
Agreed. Again, drilling down into the connection between religious engagement and sort of maybe environmental politics more broadly. So where, how, and under what conditions is religious engagement with environmental politics possible? I think we can assume that it's possible, you know, in any setting at any time, but I think your book suggests otherwise.
Yeah, I take that to be sort of the primary question that's posed across all of the chapters in the books. There is, as you say, an assumption that religious engagement is always possible. And I think that assumption is attached to a set of propositions about what counts as religious. So religious groups and actors are a certain kind of social or cultural entity that have beliefs about the world, and they can bring those beliefs to bear on any different issue, and that those beliefs can be articulated and are relatively stable. And that's not exactly how religious engagement in politics around any issue works. And I think one important part of this is that because climate change is such a broad international universal issue, that it allows us an opportunity for those of us who are interested sort of generally in how religion is engaged in public sphere issues to think comparatively about where religion does show up and when, where it doesn't, and why and why not. So I'll point to a particular chapter that I really like on this point. That's David Buckley's chapter about the Philippines. I think offhand it's chapter 2. And he is writing about the role of the Philippine Bishops Association, which is relatively powerful and influential in politics in the Philippines. And it's documenting how the Bishops Association was engaged on this issue, especially in the early years of the Duterte administration, which was also in the years immediately after the publication of Laudato Si. So important and powerful Catholic institutions had a sort of heightened incentive to engage around climate change. The Philippine Bishops Association has a long history of speaking out and acting on environmental issues generally and climate change in particular. Strangely, given his stance on other kinds of issue, President Duterte, was interested in sort of increasing the ambition of climate policy in the Philippines. And so you'd think this would be a natural space for cooperation or for the ability of a religious actor to sort of contribute to a better, stronger climate policy at the national scale. And yet that didn't happen. And so Dr. Buckley in that chapter is sort of asking why that is. And I think the insight that he provides that then we see sort of support for across other chapters is that climate change is never in a vacuum. It's always part of a broader matrix of political considerations, and that disagreements about, in the case of the Philippines, the human rights abuses connected to extrajudicial killing by the police of purported criminals, and debates and controversies around mining, another major environmental issue in the Philippines, that those disagreements ended up sort of taking precedent over climate change and pushing it to the back burner, or at least because there were such hot button issues that were sites of disagreement, that it undercut the ability to build some consensus around climate change. And that specifically, the minister that Duterte appointed around mining, who would have been an important ally, ran afoul of Duterte's connections in the corporate mining world. And that minister eventually was removed from the post. And that removal disrupted the broader conversation between the administration and the Catholic Bishops Association. So there's just the thing that I'm trying to illustrate in recounting this particular case is that there are really interesting and important and noteworthy connections between climate change and other kinds of issues that we might not think about if our assumption about how religious engagement in politics works is that it's purely ideological, that religious actors just speak up their mind about their faith convictions and that somehow magically has an influence on policy. But when you get down to it, religious stakeholders or faith groups of any kind are just like other kinds of political actors, which is that they have to pick and choose their battles, that they find moments where they can be influential, and that those moments are conditional on all sorts of other things, like the media cycle, like scandals, like conventions, like the exact composition of a legislative chamber. So those really more fine-grained details matter a lot more, and that it would, I think, behoove scholars of religion to pay attention to that kind of stuff, as opposed to just thinking that the reified ethical systems that are not articulated through politics and policy of a religion are the only thing that matters. That in fact, religions are political actors.
Yeah, this feels like an important time to remind us of the power of the idea of lived religion, right? That there's you know, the sacred text, there's perhaps what is taught on whatever day folks, you know, gather to celebrate, whether it's the Sabbath or, you know, another day. And then there's how do you actually live your faith? How do you actually live as a human being in this world? And that complicates religious engagement, but also religious and political engagement in a very human way, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a bit off topic, but I think a similar conversation could be had about how debates about reproductive rights and contraception play out in U.S. politics and policy in relationship to the Catholic Church, where the elites in the church sort of have a particular kind of theological structure that compels them to think and act in certain kinds of ways, and that the laity in the church, just public opinion polling of the laity and the lived religious experience of American Catholics is all over the map and spans the full political spectrum of how people come down on those kinds of questions. And so that depending on what it is you're trying to think about, mapping how Catholicism is related to the politics of reproductive health in the United States is much more complicated than simply articulating where the Vatican falls on that kind of an issue. And I think exactly that kind of subtlety, which most people wouldn't struggle to understand in relationship to something like reproductive rights in the United States, that kind of oversimplification still seems to govern often the way people think or talk about where religious actors show up in the overall landscape of environmental and climate issues.
Absolutely. I come from an Irish Catholic family, and long before the Vatican and the Pope signed off on birth control, you know, my family started using it after many generations of 11 or 10 children and, you know, challenges and keeping all of those children alive and healthy and fed, et cetera. So yes, there's definitely a difference between the lived religion and, you know, what the Pope says from one day to the next, or even what the priest of your, you know, of your congregation says. So,
absolutely.
So you mentioned the Philippines, and I wanted to sort of bring up a very political idea, but also sort of this variation idea that you reference in your introduction. So you referenced the resurgence of populist nationalisms, but also sort of a renewed enthusiasm for the quote unquote green left in Europe and the Americas. So obviously there's different responses, different political responses to climate change. And I'm wondering, what role do you think sort of climate change, however it is understood in these different contexts, like what role is it playing in sort of the formation of sort of new political alliances or new political sort of belief systems?
Yeah. Well, so let me make sure I understand your question clearly. Are you asking about those kinds of new political possibilities and their relationship to religion?
So there's both the new political possibilities, and I suppose I should look closely again at your language. You also say a renewed sort of enthusiasm for the green left, at least in Europe and the Americas. So just wondering, like, what role climate change is playing in either these resurgences or perhaps in new political formations, and whether that is directly connected to religion or not, sort of the political side of this, if it is separated, seems significant, because I don't think that sort of the politics of climate change is sort of, yeah, I don't think it like naturally maps on to sort of liberal politics in all settings, right? Like there's certainly settings in which sort of green politics has led to the rise of like the eugenics movement, for example. So it seems like you were starting to get into it in this introductory chapter, how sort of there's some unexpected directions that climate change is taking different sort of political traditions, whether, you know, pre-existing traditions or perhaps new formations.
Yeah. So the research project that preceded the one that is the basis of the volume we're discussing was more specifically focused on Latin America. And from that, along with my colleague Rob Albro, we edited a volume called Church and Cosmovision. And sort of the takeaway from that volume is that in many different national contexts in South America in particular, Latin America more generally, there are sort of unexpected and intriguing new alliances between Christian groups, predominantly Catholic groups, and indigenous communities, and that those alliances are built on the political terrain of around the environment and sustainability. And those wouldn't necessarily have been alliances that would have made good sense under during the sort of authoritarian era of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, where debates were more focused on economic development and political infrastructures. So the environment, one thing it does is creates new challenges that put together actors in the world of religion that we wouldn't necessarily expect. So I've written separately about this in other places as well. Generally, women's groups and organizations from the global South that were focused on sustainable development and the Vatican have not didn't used to be tightly allied because of the Vatican's stance on reproductive health, on the rights of women, on education for girls, that it was not sort of where they want, where those kinds of organizations wanted it to be. But in the post climate change, or in the era of climate change, those kinds of alliances are undergoing a major transformation. So there's sort of a strange bedfellows quality to all of this. But I also think there's other interesting kinds of dynamics around climate politics where attention to religion helps us see things more clearly. So one, we might notice the way in which rights of nature movements, which largely developed out of indigenous claims and indigenous social movements that were articulated in green tribunals and constitutional amendments in places as different as New Zealand and India and Bolivia, those kinds of movements are now taking on a secular character as they get sorted out through the courts and get taken up by green organizations of various kinds to try to champion environmental protection in different national contexts, even while those laws themselves have a sort of cultural history that can't be called totally secular. Another way we can think about all of this is that the rise of the green left in both Europe and the Americas also can't be disentangled from broader conversations about secularization. It's really difficult to think about parliamentary politics without sort of connecting the bifurcation of nationalist right-wing parties that often have some sort of connection to ethno-religious nationalism and the kinds of alternatives that are being imagined that are often not just on an economic left, but a sort of social left that incorporates both ecological considerations and broader ideals about multicultural inclusion. So that marriage of sort of a pluralistic multiculturalism that sees itself as secular and also posits a sort of optimistic view of what is possible, as it's those groups are in tension with the rising tide of populist nationalism that we see sprouting up in Europe, in the United States, in the Philippines, in India, in Brazil, all over the world.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. All over the world. I think that is something I've learned over the last 5 years. You know, it's very easy to sort of narrow your scope and think about your particular context or your national context. And yeah, these movements are definitely, finding shape all over the world in lots of different ways. But there are definitely discrete connections that we should pay attention to.
And I think people who are interested in religion generally and religion in the environment specifically have a contribution to make there, because many of the populist nationalist movements around the world are both have a revisionist traditionalism around religion. They imagine some sort of homogeneous ethnic belonging in which gender norms are reified in a way that they probably never actually ever were. And they are those movements are often quite skeptical about climate change and other kinds of issues that the best available science would want us to think progressively about. So if you see that connection between the denial that anthropogenic impacts are negatively affecting the climate and debates about gender and sexuality. And you can see that debate, that connection more clearly if you're thinking about those movements, not only from the perspective of religion, but of religion and the environment, and if you're doing it comparatively. So I think even though that's not a major focus of this volume, those of us responsible for bringing it about are trying to build a foundation of knowledge that emphasizes the importance of seeing that matrix of connections for making knowledge about religion valuable for social progress.
So building off of this sort of secularization idea, you note that there is, in your view, a secular bias within the scholarly literature on environmental politics. So I'm wondering why you think that is. What accounts for this bias? And how does this secular bias, if we can see that there is one, shape environmental politics and policy action?
Yeah. I mean, one way of thinking about this is that there is a secular bias in political science generally, that the sort of emphasis on real politic and the emphasis on identifying powerful actors and following the money, those are all really important factors in thinking about how politics works in the United States and beyond. But those are not those kinds of analyses often discount or undervalue questions of identity, questions of belonging, questions of ideology that scholars of religion would want to attend to more carefully. And wedding those things, I think, can be really powerful. So I'm not arguing that sort of quantitative measures of political influence are irrelevant, but that being able to think in your analysis of how the debates on any kind of political issue, climate change included, play out need to be able to attend to these very difficult to articulate features like how people's social identity and location informs where they give money to. I mean, how would you ever understand something like the National Rifle Association or belonging in Greenpeace without seeing, without being able to articulate a person's location in ways that are connected to religion and spirituality? So I think there remains a great need to do that kind of work. I would leave it at that.
Yeah, I would note that I see myself as an environmental studies scholar, but I am currently working within a religion and a history department. And that's partially because in sort of the environmental departments, I would have naturally sort of sought out that there was this sort of scientific element that didn't necessarily allow for conversations about, say, religion as sort of a societal factor that was of great import to, you know, climate change or environmental politics. So that dynamic, I think, at least in the United States, in the way that sort of environmental studies programs, for example, were shaped and developed, that might have something to do with this, at least in this smaller academic world.
Yeah. In environmental history generally, and maybe environmental studies more broadly, there's kind of a strong materialist bias that economic conditions, that people's livelihoods, that ecological change, that those are critical driving forces in social and political spheres. And that's true, and those things are always already connected to religious and spiritual dimensions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe our issue is that we, in an attempt to say something new about a specific thing, we sort of disaggregate these overlapping issues.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because there's so many connections, obviously, as we've been highlighting throughout this interview, and as you have highlighted through this volume. So what do you think the major contributions of this volume are? You obviously highlight the conclusions, but conclusions and contributions, they sometimes map onto each other, but not always. So maybe the major contributions and also the conclusions, maybe speak about them separately.
Sure. So for contributions, I think that this volume helps open up new possibilities for research about how religion is relevant in environmental contestations. And I would say more specifically that it helps better position emerging scholars who wish to do research of this kind to think about how religion is attenuated in particular cases around environmental issues. I think in the study of religion for a long time, there has been a pressure. Maybe this comes from older models of thinking about world religions, that we need to be able to think broadly about how a particular religion matters, or what the standing of a particular religion is vis-a-vis a particular issue. So where are American Protestants on environmental issues? And that scale just doesn't quite get it right. So by doing the work of getting into the weeds a little bit about how religion comes to matter in particular places around the same issue, and how that looks different because of the contexts where it comes to matter, I think we're providing tools and examples about how to get into the weeds to better understand that. And I think one reason that's important is that it's not just knowledge, that, as I was saying earlier, that by getting down into the fine-grained details about how people at local and national levels are thinking about climate change, responding to climate change, being impacted by climate change, being forced to rely on their cultural traditions or being compelled to transform those traditions to respond to the kinds of challenges they're facing, by getting down into those details, I think we do a much better job of humanizing the climate crisis. I so often see reporting in the mass media about climate change that even if it is about how a person's home was lost to a wildfire, those are sort of universal qualities, right? People in an ideal world have homes, and when those homes are lost, it's sad, but there's no particularity to that. I think it's really important to be able to tell stories to move people on climate change and to try to get more action and to reduce emissions, that we better understand that climate change is in people's lives. It's affecting people's lives and their cultures, and not just their economic well-being. But we need to be able to think of it as more than just a dollars and cents issue, where insurance for homes is, you know, needs to be changed or something. That it's actually affecting what they believe and how they think about their children's futures and where they think that the fate of humanity lies, and that getting at those kinds of issues is critical for transformation. So I would say that's, I guess, the core cluster of contributions. For takeaways, I think we also have, across the two volumes that are from this project, I think we're making some interesting observations about the way that religion or the climate crisis is driving religious change. One of the themes that kept coming up, and this is probably a larger part of the other volume, but some of the cases in the volume we're discussing do the same thing, which is to talk about how people's core, certain core ideas in religious life are changing. That my colleague David Haberman's chapter in the other volume, he focuses on how people's theologies about Mother Ganga, the goddess of the river Ganges, are changing. That where she was once a nurturing maternal god, there are larger and larger swaths of people who would say that she has become angry or enraged or is acting vengefully towards humanity. So there are major transformations underway. And I think that as a takeaway, being able to think about how religions are not stable objects that act on the world of politics and the environment, but rather that there's a dynamic exchange between these different spheres, and to be able to track that in ways that attend to the specific places where scholars do work. I think that's an important next step for the field more broadly.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, that religions are not static from sort of era to era, or again, even within a particular tradition at that same point in time. It seems like such an obvious point, and yet I find that some people just assume that beliefs are constant, you know, from one era to the next, and that's just not so.
It is the thing that we have to emphasize in every 100 level religious studies course we teach, and apparently also a kind of conversation that I think we could do better at having in the study of religion when we're trying to engage our peers in other disciplines that are also interested around the cultural dimensions of climate change.
Okay, so I have two final questions. They are related to the content of this volume, but could be considered a little bit tangential. But I think they are important to ask since I have such an expert on the line with me. So Evan, I am sure you are aware that there are mainstream political actors and journalists, as well as academic scholars, currently arguing that so-called believers in climate change have constructed a new climate change-based religion, or at least a social phenomenon that resembles a religion. So how do you think about this notion? Like, is there any validity to that claim, even though, you know, sometimes it comes across as sort of a diminishing claim of those people?
Yeah. So what's fascinating about this question, and it's a question that have a few friends that I've talked about this with for a very long time. There is the same observation can be made by scholars of religion and by critics of environmentalism about the religious qualities of environmental concern. So you could have someone on the one hand, like Bron Taylor, there at the University of Florida, who has astutely observed the religious qualities of environmentalism, has thought about how those have played out in social movements in the United States for many decades, and how we can use the tools of religious studies to better understand environmental social movements. That is excellent and important scholarship, and I have no objection to noting. I actually think we can much more adequately understand what drives people to religion, to environmental action, how social movements take shape by attending to these religion-resembling qualities. But at the same time, it's ironic and troubling that the group that has most successfully latched on to or independently come up with the same idea are a particular kind of anti-environmental conservative who wish to use that religion-resembling argument to try to paint environmentalism as a heresy against some other form of religiosity, to use it to invalidate it. So I think there's sort of two independent claims there that are working together that maybe we need to separate out. So the one is, does environmentalism broadly have religion-resembling characteristics? I think the answer is unambiguously yes. And the question then becomes, what do you do with that resemblance? Does that invalidate it or make it somehow socially problematic? And this is, of course, the classic distinction between religious studies and theology. Scholars of religion are trying to understand certain kinds of phenomena and traditions in the world and to bring them into clearer analytic focus, as opposed to trying to say particular kinds of religion are the ones you should or should not have. So I'm reminded specifically of it's Michael Crichton, you know, the of Jurassic Park frame, who in 2003 at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco gave a talk called "Environmentalism as a Religion," and the whole idea is that it is a form of false prophecy and like secular manipulation of our youth that we should think of as very dangerous. And that's a direction where I wouldn't want to take this, despite the fact that it keeps getting played that way in various to various audiences. That's a political rhetoric as opposed to an analytic rhetoric.
Indeed. I will say, though, I've recently Googled climate change as religion. And of course, the first links that come up are more this sort of anti-environmental conservative approach rather than sort of a religious studies approach or another approach.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yes.
That's because the right wing political infrastructure in the United States is much more media savvy than, say, the academy.
100%. And perhaps that explains a lot of the reason we are talking today. So you were currently correct. I believe I'm correct in saying this. I know that presidencies pass on and Lisa Sedaris will soon be, but you are currently the president of the International Society for the Study of Religion, Nature, and Culture, correct?
Yes.
Yes, I thought so. Okay. So
Dr. Sedaris will become president, I think, in the spring of this coming year.
Okay. Wonderful. Could you just tell us a bit about the work of the society and its mission? I think it's relevant to the work that you've done in this book, and I think might be of interest to this audience.
Sure. The International Society for the Study of Religion, Nature, and Culture was founded in 2005 by a group of scholars headed by Bron Taylor, but many others. The idea is that it is an interdisciplinary group dedicated to the advancement of all academic research in this area. We do a lot of work, both in the at the board level and in terms of planning conferences, that are focused on bringing folks from new disciplinary orientations into the conversation and on helping support early career researchers who work on topics where nature and culture and religion are connected in whatever ways might make sense. So we welcome in particular graduate students, folks in disciplines like geography or anthropology or environmental philosophy, study of religion, many different fields that are engaged in those kinds of questions. And we have social media feeds, we have opportunities for people who are members to interact in private collaboration and conversation online. But the two focal emphases of our work are the publication of a journal, the Journal for the Study of Religion, Nature, and Culture, which is a quarterly journal published by Equinox and is increasingly a highly cited, impactful journal. And then conferences, which are held roughly every 18 months. The next conference will be held at Arizona State University in early February of 2023. And the title, the thematic title of that conference is After Earth, Religion and Technology on a Changing Planet. And so we're thinking in the call for papers, which you can see on our website, issrnc.org. You can kind of get down into the details, see that we're asking questions about Afrofuturism, about the role of geoengineering in and theological responses to geoengineering, questions about space colonization and space travel, sort of messianic depictions of environmental leaders, questions of how to think about solar technology and lithium extraction and fossil fuels, and how those kinds of questions are being addressed from within and across spiritual and religious traditions. So lots of interesting things in that CFP, and we invite anybody interested broadly in the study of religion, nature, and culture to attend and present at the conferences. And yeah, that's what we're up to.
All right, thank you. So this concludes another episode of the New Books Network. My guest has been Evan Berry. So thank you for joining me today, Evan.
Thank you for having me, Brady. I really enjoyed our conversation.
All right. And thank you, everyone, for listening.